Hey there, and welcome to episode 28 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we have Michael Vandenham, an up-and-comer in the Canadian cyclocross scene. This was a fun one, sort of came about on a whim. I had a couple shows planned that got pushed back on the schedule and had an empty date and put it out there on Twitter that I was looking for somebody to talk to. And Mike said, hey, what about me? And I thought that was a great idea. He's definitely somebody who has been on my list of people I wanted to talk to. And it's a neat story. I think he's got a lot of good information and just stories about going over to Belgium and also starting in Canada, racing in the US, and just an all-around good guy. I had a great conversation with Mike that you guys are going to hear in a second. Wide Angle Podium Network, that's the one thing I want to tell you all about before we get started with our conversation. Go to wideanglepodium.com. It is a podcast network. The Slow Ride Podcast, Honest Bicycle Program, Kids Don't Follow, and now the Meyerson Line along with Crosshairs Radio, all on there. If you become a member, you can donate each month to all of these shows. It doesn't have to be a lot of money, but it helps us as a collective pay our server costs, buy new equipment, and just keep on doing what we're doing and bringing you a lot of really great content. Go there, check it out, and let's talk to Mike. All right, Michael, how's it going?
Good. How about yourself, Phil?
I am doing just fine. Thanks for joining us today for Crosshairs Radio.
Yeah, I think I might be, am I the first person ever to reach out to you about being on Crosshairs Radio? Did I set, your show's big enough now that people want to be on and are asking you, or has that happened before?
It has happened, but I love how it happened this time, because you know you were definitely somebody who was on my radar, but just throwing it out there on Twitter and having you say, hey, I'll do it, that was awesome. I loved it. That's great.
Yeah, I was sitting there and I saw your tweet go out. I was like, I guess. I've been listening, and it came about because I've been listening to the podcast a whole bunch the day before on one of these mind-numbingly boring four-hour rides.
Yeah, I saw your shout out to Wide Angle about listening, I guess, to us and the Slow Ride.
Yeah, I listened actually to the first Meyerson Line.
Oh, that's what it was, right? Yeah,
they don't do that in Europe's. And then saw your tweet and I was like, yeah, you know what? I've been following the website for a long enough time and watched all the Sven Ness videos and been listening to some of the podcasts, and it was sort of like, I think I'd like to, you know, tell my story about cyclocross too.
And I think it's definitely one worth telling. And let's do that. Let's just okay. First off, I need to do this so when I do my intro, I get it right. It's Michael Vandenham. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Maybe if you were Flemish or something, it'd be like Michael Vandenham. But
I'm not.
Yeah. That's funny. Whenever they would call me up to races in Belgium, they would just look at my number, and usually the American riders, they'll call out your number in English and then say your name, right? So
yeah,
for some riders it's easy. It's like number 23, Stephen Hyde. But for me, my number would always be in Flemish or always be in Dutch, and they'd be like, Michael Vandenham. I'm sitting at Starbucks and be like, wait, what? Oh, that's me. I gotta go.
You're lucky you didn't Well, maybe you didn't show up on the results with like a Dutch flag next to it.
Yeah, that kept on happening to one of to Michael Dick.
For oh, like, yeah?
Five races in a row over Kerst period. She kept on being Belgian, I think. Like, too good to be Canadian. You must be from somewhere else.
Exactly. But yeah, let's just, you know, because I think that probably people in the races that you race in the U.S., you know, in the New England area, and then also for the, I guess, for Vegas, stuff like that, people know your name, but I think there are a lot of people out there who are not familiar with you. So let's just start with, you know, where you're from and how you got into cycling.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're right. I think I've sort of hovered around the cyclocross scene in a number of different places. I was in New England for a while, for a season, but for the most part, I've been based out of Canada and based out of Edmonton, Alberta. But going back before that, I was actually born in Brandon, Manitoba, which is geography lesson, basically the dead center of Canada, just a little bit above North Dakota and probably one of the flatter places you can come from in the world. So it's a little bit funny that I'm a cyclist at all. But I think it really stemmed out of, I started riding bikes as like a, a method of transportation. We lived out in the country, and I guess I was an independent kid growing up, and I decided at grade 7 or grade 8 that I wanted to save up some money and bike the 15 kilometers to and from school. And at that point, it was very, it's like my mom would still drive to school in the car to make sure I got there safely and give me a change of clothes. But I just wanted to do the biking part.
Yeah, that's cool. Were you doing any other sports, or was this just...
Being a Canadian kid, I'd grown up playing some pond hockey and then played in a couple recreational leagues. And like I'd played soccer growing up. I played a little bit of rugby later on, but I don't think I was particularly good at any of them.
And cycling, that was just transportation. I mean, did you have any interest or knowledge of actually bike racing?
I just don't think I knew that that type of thing existed for the first little while when I did it. And then as I got older, my older brother, who's 14 years older than me quite a bit, was living out in Ontario in the Ottawa area, where there's a way bigger cycling scene. And I think he sort of planted the bug in my ear that I could, you know, that I could race and that I could get a road bike. And then I would remember that we would talk for hours on the phone about bike parts and road bikes and stuff like that. So from a source of transportation, I think I sort of got that idea from him that, oh, maybe I could race, and started subscribing to Bicycling magazine. But looking back, it's like, I have no idea why I did that, really. Brandon is a town of 40,000 people. I was probably the only person under the age of 40 who had a road bike.
So is your brother, is he the other Vandenham showing up on the results for the Masters for like Canadian Nationals?
Yeah, he won Masters Nationals, I think, 2 years ago, and is... he's a very good road racer, but it's like he's always done it as a hobby, I guess, at a high level one, but always as a hobby, and has a family now.
Right. So, but coming from, you know, small town, 40,000, you know, nobody else riding bikes, how did it become, you know, how did you actually get into racing?
Yeah, I got into racing because I eventually just became sort of a bike nerd. Like when I was buying my bikes, I would go into all the shops and get all the catalogs I possibly could from all the different bike brands I could, and get them to write the prices in, and, you know, go back and forth and compare components and all this different stuff. And eventually, because I was doing that so often, sort of landed myself a job at a bike shop. And that bike shop ended up hosting a race, and they just wanted their employees to do the race, right? As good advertising for them. They thought since the race was in town, they should have some people in it. And I signed up. It was a mountain bike race, and ended up winning my category in my first race ever, and sort of realized like, oh, this is the first sport I've ever been good at. Like, this, you know, winning's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's definitely something that once you do it, you want to do it again.
Mm-hmm. And then that season I ended up racing a whole pile more in the area, and ended up winning a whole pile more races. And it just sort of grew from there. Then I ended up riding on, Manitoba has like a, I guess it's a provincial program. So there's a provincial coach, who's based out of Winnipeg, which is 3 or 4 times the size of my town, Brandon. So I ended up connecting with them a little bit the next season, and ended up traveling to mountain bike nationals for a couple of years in a row. And then eventually I ended up moving actually to where I am now, Edmonton, Alberta, for university. And until that point, I had heard of cyclocross, but there were no races in Brandon, no races, barely any races in Winnipeg, which is funny because, that was only 5 years ago. And then looking back now, the last 2 years, I think you could say that Winnipeg's easily had the best national championships we've ever had in Canada.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it seems like even, you know, just nationally, the scene is starting to go through a real explosion in Canada. It seems like races are popping up everywhere now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Cross on the Rock series, which that's where they hosted Single Speed Worlds out of this year, has a very West Coast scene, you know, a lot of fun. And then I think there's developing a lot of scenes all over the place. Like even our local scene in Alberta draws 150 to 200 racers, and we have doubleheader weekends every weekend for, I think, 8 or 9 weekends in a row.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
And I mean, it's actually created a reasonable talent pool. If you look at like Mark McConnell is racing out here all the time. So Hot Sauce.
Right. Yep.
Aaron Schooler used to be racing out here all the time. And you may be not as familiar with him but he spent the last few seasons over in Europe and has been on the Nationals podium in Canada.
Sure. Yeah. Wasn't he, did he get second this year or?
He was third this
year.
Third.
Okay.
Yeah. He out-sprinted me. So it's like through that, it's actually developed a pretty good scene in Edmonton. But yeah, I moved here for university, and like the very first thing I did, I don't know why I had it in my head that I wanted to race cross, but I just did. So like the first thing I did when I got here is went around to all the bike shops looking for a cross bike and ended up buying a Santa Cruz Stigmata, which was super cool, still is super cool.
Nice.
I wish I had it. And raced that first season and just got absolutely destroyed. But something about the sport like made me want to come back for more and more and more. And I guess it just grew out of that.
Yeah, so putting it into perspective, how many years is that ago?
This would be 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's not really that long ago, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, looking back on it, it doesn't seem like long, but I'm sure going through it, you've probably, you know, just from the progression you've gone through, it probably seems like a whole lifetime ago.
Yeah, I knew absolutely nothing then about cyclocross, about, you know, like I think like every new cross racer, I was running 50 PSI in my tires and crashing in every corner and wondering like, oh, why is this happening to me? Well, it's because you're running 50 PSI in your tires.
So just culturally and sort of the races that you're racing when you're starting out, I'm assuming smaller events, what's that scene like? What does it look like? And how has it sort of changed over the last 5 or 6 years?
Oh, I mean, I absolutely love the Edmonton scene. I think you find this with cross scenes all over the place, but it's like a big welcoming family, right? Unlike a lot of, especially road, which is my summer occupation, it's so much more friendly and so much more low key. But in terms of the actual racing, I think the biggest thing is we've seen a big improvement in the quality of courses. In terms of actual participants, the Edmonton scene itself and the whole Alberta scene has, I don't want to say stagnated, but it's hit the level that it's probably going to stick at for a while just because of population density.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's everywhere. It's like big growth and then it just sort of plateaus and you hope it doesn't go down.
And I don't think it will. I mean, we always have more people than we have weekends trying to host races. And I think that's been steadily driving up the quality of races.
What's the season? Do you all start earlier and finish, you know, in December-ish, or what does the season go to?
Oh, we can't even make December.
Yeah.
So out here, we start first week of September, September long weekend. So even before Rochester. And then we go until usually the end of October, maybe the first week in November.
Okay.
And sometimes like this, sometimes there's snow in the first week of November. I've raced in lots of snow races. I raced in the snow and then basically went straight to CXLA one year.
Oh, geez.
Such a contrast.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were probably, in Coke side of this year for Worlds, probably hoping for the snow they were threatening that never showed up.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. That one year where I raced in the snow, I also did Jingle Cross, and that was 2 years ago, and it snowed in Jingle Cross that year too.
Right.
I was like sitting inside, you know, sort of giggling with glee because I'm like, I'm the only person here that has ridden in the snow this year. I'm sure of it. And sure enough, I ended up getting second on the on the snowy day, which was by far my best result that year. You know, I was like punching so far above my weight that day. And I think, I mean, it had a little bit to do with me just being exceptionally confident and being able to ride the snow. And you know, when you're confident, that just boosts everything you're able to do. You can go a little bit harder. You're riding better.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I think I said Coke Side of a World. I meant Zolder.
Yeah.
You know, my years mixed up. So, yeah, we're, you know, sort of skipping ahead. So how do you make it from racing during, you know, you're there for university, you're starting racing to, hey, this may be something that I can, you know, really do?
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think this may be a case for a lot of athletes, but it was simply so that someone was believing in me. And Sean Adamson, my coach who had been my coach for 5 years, took me aside the first year I did cross nationals and said, you know what, I think you can go to Worlds next year. And I was like, really? Are you sure? I don't know. And so Sean's part of Cycle Smart. So I've been a part of the Cycle Smart family basically from when I realized that I could do more with the sport and still am today. So I owe them a huge debt of gratitude because basically Sean went to Adam Meyerson and said, oh, I have this kid, Mike. I think he could go somewhere in the sport. He's, you know, he wants to do it. He has some talent. And to Adam's credit, never having met me, never having heard a thing about me, said, great, sounds good. Let's put him on the Cycle Smart grassroots team. Looking back, I can't help but wonder, like, why did Adam do that? I don't know. I think that's just the type of person he is, that he wants other people to experience what he's had a chance to experience in the sport.
Yeah, and I think he also trusts Sean that he saw something in you. And
and then basically every year from there, I think I've made incremental improvements every year. There's not, maybe some people would say I've jumped onto the scene 1 year, but I, looking back from the long term, I got a little bit better every single year. And then there comes a point when people just start noticing, even though you were only 5% slower the year before, right?
And then there also comes a point when you want to start progressing in the sport and you become, you know, Cat 1 racer, you get a UCI license, and then you really have to go to the US, right, to race. There's no place to race in Canada at that point to get any UCI points.
Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest steps I made, I guess this would be 3 years ago already, is that I went over and spent an entire season in New England and lived with Adam, then raced all of the New England races around there. And to look at, like, this is to any new racers too, just to look at the progression I made in that season alone, it was huge, from going to just absolutely getting pummeled in Baltimore and Providence and Gloucester to, by the end of the season, you know, I was never a podium threat or anything like that year, but from the end of the season, I was consistently finishing between 5th and 10th in every single, and they're the smaller C2s, but in every single UCI race I did, to capping that season off with winning U23 Nationals. It's like, I don't think I could have done that without sort of going over and just sticking myself in that and being willing to get absolutely destroyed for a few weekends, for a month. And I sort of carried that same mentality over to my Belgium trip this year. It's like, you're going to go over and it's going to be really hard for a little while. But out of that, you sort of, if it goes one way or the other, you either get way better or you get destroyed and don't want to race this sport anymore, right?
Yeah, I was, you know, I was reading your journal entry on your website, which is mvdhcyclocross.com, about that Belgian trip. And it really seems similar to what you're talking about, you know, coming from your Canadian scene to doing that New England races and that whole scene where it's much more intense, it's much faster. And, you know, you talk about this with your Belgian experience, that at a certain point after getting pummeled and everything, you're like, you know what, I it's mental, you know, I belong here. And then you started racing better. And maybe even like talk about that and that Belgian B race that you did and how that all sort of clicked for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was that the B race that you're talking about was really a turning point in my season over there. So to go back a little bit before, we showed up just in time for Asper Havre, raced Coxsida, raced, I think Hama was also that, also around that time. And it was okay. I was having a tough time making lots of mistakes, but even more than that, I think it was just, you're going from watching all of these racers on TV and seeing all these super iconic courses. And like, we didn't exactly jump into the easiest races out there. Havre is brutal. Coxsida is Coxsida. And Hama was just a big, crazy mud fest. But yeah, you go from seeing all these races on TV and being like, oh, this is, you know, Sven Nys is here and Wout van Aert and all these guys. And being like, I don't know if I really sort of expecting to be riding around the back of that race. And I did a good job of mentally preparing myself to go from winning races to riding around the back. But I almost did too good of a job of that. Whereas I had I expected myself to be back there. And it turns out that riding off the back of these races isn't a lot of fun, and it's very frustrating, and you just can't push yourself to that limit when you're not actually racing people. And I had heard from lots of people, from Steph Wyman, from Sean, from a whole pile of people, like, oh, you should really go out and do a B race just for training purposes too, because it's so important to get that full hour of racing in. You know, if you're getting pulled two or three laps down, you're racing for 45 or 50 minutes, and you're just, you're gradually losing your ability to race for an hour.
Yeah, and explain what this B race is, because I think a lot of us, when we see cyclocross in Belgium and sort of, you know, what we're brought to understand is that it's, you know, unlike the U.S., unlike Canada, it's not a participatory sport. You have your pros who race, and you have your spectators, and that's it. So that this other scene actually exists where there are these other races out there that Sven isn't showing up to, but just mere mortals are racing. Still awesome guys, still guys that can, you know, race in these super prestige races and everything else. But there's this whole other scene out there that we never see.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I think what a lot of people don't know is that, or don't realize, like, we talk a lot about start money in Belgian races, and everybody knows that Sven makes whatever it is, 8,000 euros per start, or whatever he made in his last year, I have no idea. And the start money sort of cascades down until you have the guys in the back of the field making 150 or 300 euros per start. What people don't realize is when most Belgian racers don't get offered a start contract, they do not race the UCI races. That's just something that doesn't happen. It's like, it's their job. If you're not paid to go to work, you wouldn't go to work, right?
Right, right.
So when they don't have a start contract, that's when they go and race these B races. And basically the B races are, you're not allowed to race them if you have a paying professional contract. So in Belgium, that's anyone in those pro races who clears over 30,000 euros a year.
And the crazy thing about that is always a shock, it's not more than 20 people.
Yeah, it's only, I think it's 18 or 20 guys.
Yeah, because they used to do that when they would split up before, I think this last year in the Belgian National Championship, when they would split up the field, and you see it, and there's like 15 guys up there, and that's it. You know, you're like, this is the home of cyclocross, and only 15 guys are really in what they would consider a pro with a contract.
And I don't know what the economics behind that are, because the pro standards, it's much like being a pro continental road racer. Like, the standard is pretty high. It's not like you can be a pro on some crappy continental road team and not be getting paid, right?
Right.
The standard's higher than that in Belgium for cyclocross. So maybe the guys who aren't technically pros are getting a living stipend or something. But
I think there might also be like some tax reason for it, and it comes down to stuff that I don't have any understanding of.
But like, the point is, there are some really good guys who aren't pros. Jan de Nieuwelaere.
Sure.
It's capable of being in the top 10 on a good day, and you see him like riding in the Vast Good Kralin jersey, and you go, oh, this guy must be a professional, right? And he's not. But so anyway, so back to the B racing. So outside of anyone who doesn't have a professional contract can race these B races. And the guys who race them are the guys who don't have a pro contract and weren't offered a start contract. But for example, for the ones I did, we still had Kevin Kant, who rides for the ERA Cordon team, and one of the Sweek brothers, one of the youngest brother, I think his name is Hendrik, And still, like, there's still really good racers showing up to these. And then there's a whole list of Belgian amateur teams that offer really good support for cyclocross, like on the level that these guys are good enough that they would be at the front of any race in North America, right? And the whole B race is the production value, how the course is laid out, the spectators, there's beer gardens. It's not a small thing. It's a whole, to use a hockey reference, like there's the NHL and then this is the AHL. Or baseball, it's like this is the AAA league and then there's the major leagues.
Right. This isn't a grassroots race that's just thrown up in a field. This is still a professional production.
Yeah, it's still a big production. And I think the caliber of field is what you would see at any, certainly any UCI C2 race in North America. That's kind of what I would compare it to. And people over here just don't realize that that exists.
Right.
It's not advertised. Like, it's almost impossible even as a racer trying to figure out where this race is and what you need to do to race it. It's almost comically difficult. You're like clicking. Belgians don't really believe in websites or the internet.
No, they certainly don't.
And they certainly don't believe in graphic design. So you're like clicking through all these really poorly constructed, like, websites that would be difficult to figure out what you're trying to do if they were in English, but they're actually all in Flemish. Like, you're trying to figure out what time does the race start? I don't know. I have to go to 3 different websites and follow them through. It's like, what do I need? Do I have to sign up? No, you just show up and you give them, I think it's 5 euros that you get back at the end of the race.
Really?
For your number. Oh yeah, it's even at the B races, I don't know how they make money doing it. Because all you do is you pay for your number and you get your money back at the end of the race. Like, it's all through sponsorship dollars.
Yeah. Are they charging admission for spectators?
That's a good question.
Yeah, because that's the different, you know. Mm-hmm. It is funny, but they have the people that will actually come up to and watch races and pay for it, and that's something that we definitely don't have here.
Piles of people that it's such a different culture in terms of, like, the fan culture in Belgium is so different. It's the equivalent of football fans in North America, right? Or in America.
Right.
That's
yeah.
The Belgian cyclocross fans. Is there middle-aged men drinking beer and hanging out while watching a race?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, and I know that I just for people listening who are like, you skipped 2 years in there, you know, let's talk about this and that experience in the B races, and then I sort of want to jump back to after like 2013 and then how you sort of got to the point where you were going to Belgium and having those opportunities. But yeah, talk about your experience with this B race.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. This is typical of me. My brain sort of goes in all different routes at once.
I'm taking the blame for this. I shot you ahead in the timeline.
And now I'm just, it's a snowball effect. It's going to accelerate and soon we'll be projecting into 2030 and I'll be talking about that. Who knows what. Anyways, B race. So the point of that is that the B race it's a proper race, but much more of the caliber that I'm used to racing in the States at a UCI race. And that was so valuable because I showed up, I traveled a lot with another Australian, Gary Milburn, who I think you've talked about a little bit on the show.
Yeah, yeah. I was able to spend a little time with him in CX Tokyo recently.
Who's an absolutely awesome guy. You should all cheer for him to win Australian CX Nats, especially after last year where he should have won anyways. But so I was traveling around with him and we made this decision to go to the B race, and it's like, we got called up last row because it's not by UCI points, but just getting used to the feeling of racing through people and racing with people, it almost made me fall back in love with the racing again, right? It's like I've gone from a number of weekends in the row where I feel like I'm pedaling around at the back of the field and I never really felt like I was racing. And
right.
Then being able to jump in and go hard for this full hour and finish the race, you know, with a sprint finish and be riding through groups this entire time. I think I ended up finishing fifth or something.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Which I wish I had started in the front row because it would have been fun to see if I could have factored in the win. But anyways, being able to do this full hour and then at the end of it realizing, like, oh, these guys that I was just racing against, these guys that I went from the back row to catch, like, these guys also do the Super Prestige and the B Post, right? So I sort of just clicked that it's not that I'm physically incapable of racing those races. It's just that I was being intimidated by the fact that these were only things I had seen on TV, and these were races only, you know, I thought that it was so out of my league that I couldn't participate. And that was proving to be a huge inhibitor. And to go back and realize, like, okay, this is a guy that I'm capable of racing against, right? This is another guy I'm capable of racing against. I just need, in the UCI races, I just need to get to their group, and I know I can stick it out once I'm there. And it was such a mentality shift of going from feeling like I was sort of out there for the experience, being out there to go, you know what, yeah, I'm not racing for first place, but I am racing, and I'm going to go and get the absolute best place I can, and I know that I'm capable of competing with those Belgians at the back of the field. It was just a big mentality shift. And maybe I had sort of set myself up, you know, because another mistake that you can make is going over to Belgium and having too high of expectations and getting those absolutely destroyed. But I had made the opposite mistake and had gone in with sort of too low of expectations. Turns out when you have low expectations, it's really easy to meet them.
Yeah. And it seems like you've in both of those experiences, going to New England and racing there, and then, you know, why I wanted to skip ahead to this Belgian experience is that, yeah, I think, you know, we all do it. We get into these new scenes and you sort of have a little of that imposter syndrome, like you don't belong to be there. So it's sort of breaking through that and realizing that, you know, you can compete. And I'm sure that's going to be valuable for you in the coming season.
Absolutely. And everyone does this too, is you, when you race enough in one scene, you find your people, right? Like, these are the people I race against and I'm battling it out with every single weekend. And doing that also helped me find my people. Like, I raced against the handful of Belgian guys basically every single weekend. And, you know, it's like it just gives you a good gauge to go off your races. If you're ahead of them, you know, you're doing pretty well. If you're behind them, it gives some extra motivation to push to catch that group.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of when I was talking to Stephen Hyde on this show, and he's talking about, you know, one of the first races that he's doing, and he's, you know, like, oh, I'm up here racing with like Adam Meyerson and Dan Chabanov, and yeah. You know, and it was like he had such put everybody on this, you know, on this pedestal, and then, yeah, you know, you look at it a couple years later and those guys are doing all they can just to stay in his group.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny because Hyde came up to this system like really, really quickly too, from going, I think there's that one year where he seemed to consistently finish 11th and couldn't get UCI points to save his life.
Right.
Three or four years later, and he's certainly the second best cross racer in North America. And you could say that maybe he's as good as, or getting as good as Powers too.
He's definitely on that trajectory. We'll say that. So I want to sort of take a step. I do want to talk more about Belgium and Europe, but I want to take a step back, because this is when you were living with Adam. That was, you did that, and then that was the year that you won nationals for U23, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's that experience like? What are the fields, you know, fields like that you're racing against, and what does that do for your motivation going forward?
You mean the fields I was racing against at nationals or in New England?
Nationals. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, going from that New England, coming back to nationals, you must have, it's almost that imposter in reverse where you're like, I've just dealt, you know, with some of these, with the fastest fields in North America. And then going back to nationals, that must have been such a great confidence boost.
Oh, absolutely. It was, like I won nationals that year by a couple minutes or something. Like it was a decent margin. But I don't want to say that I certainly didn't know I was going to win going in, but I was confident. I remember being really disappointed that Jeremy Martin wasn't going to race U23 nationals because I wanted someone, like, I just really wanted someone to battle, and I wanted to felt like I had really, really earned it. No disrespect to the people that raced it that year, but I was the only one of all the U23s that had dedicated myself to cyclocross that season, right? Everyone else had done a full road season or a full mountain bike season. And it's just, that's just different. You know, they're all better at what they do than me. But since I'd spent so much time on the cross bike and raced so much in New England, I expected myself to be able to do that well. And yeah, I guess I was right. So being in New England that whole time and racing against these people, and I'd raced against sort of some of the guys in Canada who were going to do well at U23, like Evan McNeely and Jeremy Martin, who didn't end up going. And it just let me go into nationals going, you know what, I know I can do this. I know I'm, I guess, the favorite, and it just worked out. There's not much more to it than that.
Yeah. So I find it interesting. I was just thinking about Canadian cyclocross, and, you know, in the U.S., we still think of ourselves as this niche sport, you know, which certainly are. It's small comparatively. I'm thinking about your scene, and it's like you got to be looking at U.S. cyclocross thinking it's this, you know, it's so much bigger than that. It's just, yeah, it's just the relative scale of everything. Mm-hmm. I find sort of interesting.
Yeah. The scene is growing in Canada, but it's just like, just in terms of how big our country is, it's obviously it's pretty much the same size as the U.S., a little bit bigger. And how sparsely dense, how few people live here and how much they're spread apart. Like, the scene's never going to grow as big as the U.S. is. I think that's pretty simple. But somehow through that, Canada has a pretty good track record of developing good cross racers, good mountain bikers, and even good road cyclists. And
Jeff Kabush still showing up and doing well in nationals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a terrible mountain bike season. I think he was injured for most of it. And he's had a kind of a rough last couple mountain bike seasons. But he's one of those guys that, I mean, I'm sure he would never trade going to the Olympics for anything, but one of those guys, you're like, oh, if you were coming into the sport now, you could be such a good cross racer.
Yeah.
Because he was coming into it when it just wasn't as big. And you look at what he was able to do when he was on sort of his peak 5 or 6 years ago, and he was always up there at the USGP races, always one of the best. So yeah, someone you think like, he loves mountain biking, he probably wouldn't do it anyways, but it's like you could have done really well for Canada at the World Championships had you been a cross racer.
Yeah. So back to getting that U23 national. So that's what is that? Three years ago?
2000. Now our nationals years are different than yours because we race nationals in November typically.
Oh, all right.
So I believe it was 2013.
Okay. Okay, so this year's would have been 2015.
Yeah, this year was our 2015.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, so 2 years ago, where do things progress from there? I mean, what is cycling now, you know, would you consider this a career, and how did that jump happen, and then how is it that you're now racing in Worlds and able to go to Belgium for cyclocross in Europe and really have a career of it?
So through 2013 and 2014, I was busy finishing up my university degree, so I never really, like after I came back from New England, I did a semester and then I did another year. So I never really dedicated myself to racing fully. Like, it was always, I was doing the half and half thing, I guess, you know, you go to the races. I think lots of racers have this experience. Katie Antineau would always talk about, you know, flying back on Sunday night, and Zach McDonald when he was racing. And that's what I was doing too. You fly back as soon as you can. Or I remember doing homework at the races in between races and stuff like that. But then this last year, I graduated last May, I decided to really give a go of it. And as a part of that, I, along with a good friend of mine, Craig Ritchie, started our own team. So Red Truck Arno is run by the two of us. And then we had Natasha Elliott and Raph Gagne.
Oh, nice. So I didn't realize that was, that you had started that team. So how did that opportunity, or how did you feel like you needed to create that opportunity to start a team?
Yeah, that's exactly it. As I felt the need to create the opportunity, as I went, okay, I'm going to have to if I want to do this, I need to make this work for myself. And part of that I felt was starting a cross team, because there just wasn't that many other options out there. And the reason people probably don't know that it's our cross team is that it's a deviation of the road team that Craig and I have both ridden for the past 3 years, which is Trek Red Truck. But when it actually comes down to it, we took on the Trek Red Truck sponsors as one of our own sponsors, and then arranged everything else, from Garneau to all of our great smaller sponsors. Easton's a big one for us, and then Gork Bar, Crank Brothers, the list goes on.
I'm gonna plead ignorance. What is the Red Truck part of it?
So Red Truck is a beer.
Okay.
Out of Vancouver, and they've been sponsoring a road team for 25 years.
I feel like I've lost cyclocross cred now that I didn't know a beer.
It's only in BC.
Okay.
They only started bottling 2 years ago, but they're growing quickly. So hopefully at least those other Washington State people will be able to see their stuff soon.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, so they've sponsored an amateur road team for years and years. Like Swain Tuft rode with them, Will Routley rode with them.
Oh, nice, Lee, yeah.
Rode with them. A lot of good cyclists, road cyclists from the west coast of Canada have ridden for Trek Red Truck at some point in time. So they as Trek Red Truck supported me the season before this last one, and I rode a Trek bike. But then this next year, Craig and I set out to make something a little bit better with some of the support from the Trek Red Truck team. So we sort of took on Trek Red Truck as the whole team as a sponsor, and then added in our own sponsors.
Okay. And you were able to just from the go though, add more riders like Raphael on there. I mean, that's it. You've created this really strong team just from basically from nothing.
Yeah. And I think I'm pretty proud of this too, but I think people think our team is a lot bigger and a lot more well-funded than it actually is. Because I think we did our very best to make it seem like a super smooth professionally run outfit, and that was always our goal, and that still is our goal moving forward. But I'm sure, like any other cross teams out there, like we're running on a shoestring budget for sure.
Right. Yeah. No. But you did. I mean, I had that impression, especially as I mentioned before, that CSI weekend from this year, where it seems like you guys were all over the front of that.
Yeah, it was great, absolutely great to bring Raph on. Raph's a completely classy guy, and obviously one of the most talented mountain bikers and hardest working mountain bikers in North America. So it was great to have him on. He came on the team basically because Louis Garneau, the guy himself, Louis Garneau, said they wanted a Quebec rider because Garneau's interests are obviously, they're based out of Quebec, and basically went and dug into his own pocketbook and said, you know what, we want Raph Gagné, we want him to race cross again, so let's put him on the team.
That's great. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Coming in to this year, this past season that just finished up, what were really, since you were doing it full time now, what were your expectations, your goals, and how do you think it played out?
One of my big goals for coming into this year is I wanted to win a UCI race. I wanted to win nationals, which obviously I wasn't able to do. I wanted to get a top 10 at one of the big C1 races, or the only one I was going to, Providence. And then the goal was to go over to Europe. And I didn't put any, like I said, I didn't really have a lot of expectations because I'd heard so many other people who had gotten over and had all these expectations just to have them. It's hard over there, and it's really different than what we're used to, just in terms of the physical effort to do a race. We don't have courses here like they have in Europe. We don't have mud here like they have in Europe. It's just the physical effort is different. So then I just wanted to go over to Europe, and I always was, still am, and using Europe as a tool to make myself better for future. So better for the future in North America, but also better for future times going back to Europe. I don't think anyone can go over for the first time and expect to do well, because there's so much you have to learn. And even going back and doing the same courses over and over again, even if your fitness level is the same, if you do the same course twice, you're just going to do better at it.
Just that familiarity too. I mean, just
mm-hmm. I mean, the first three or four races I did in Europe, there was every single one I came across the finish and was sitting there like, oh, I wish we could just restart the race and I could do it again because I know I can do better.
When you're over in Europe for like World Cups and especially for Worlds, what is the national federation support like for you?
For most of it, we're on our own. So Cycling Canada did two projects this year. They did one for Zolder through the rest of Kerst period, and they did one for Hogerheide and for the World Championships. Now we all had the option to either opt in or opt out of the Christmas period one, but everyone has to race the World Championships with our country. I mean, that's the same for everyone from Belgium through Canada. Now, to their credit, Cycling Canada ran really tightly run programs. They brought on great mechanics. Everything was as professional as it possibly could be on their end. But the sad reality of it is they just don't have any money to put at it. And that's not a fault of the federation. That's just what it is.
Yeah, which is, you know, on a little different scale, but sort of similar to what U.S. athletes go through as well, where, you know, they're raising money to be able to go race for their country.
Exactly. And people, I think Canada, the U.S., probably people all over the place, like, we make a fun game of sort of ragging on our federation and criticizing them for everything that goes wrong. But I don't know, a lot of times it's just they don't have the money and it's a really hard job.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I used to be in that camp, and I've sort of been changing over into trying to see what can be done to be more productive. Mm-hmm. And actually find ways for people to get money rather than just to blame, you know, USA Cycling, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So Cycling Canada did a great job this year. They put together a cyclocross commission, and that was a big step in the right direction. Is as opposed to having cyclocross lumped under road or mountain bike or something else, it's now is the project is run by a bunch of people that really love cyclocross and know what needs to go into it to get the job done. And that was a huge step in the right direction, because you see from some other countries, Australia is an example of one, their cyclocross is under their mountain bike, and like they got aerodynamic speed suits 1 year to race Worlds in. And actually that happened to us just a couple years ago too. You're getting like a time trial V-neck speed suit. So like, what am I supposed to do with this?
So you can't even stand up in it.
Exactly. And back to the level of support is there's really not a lot of a lot of funding. So I raced all of the World Cups sort of on my own. And then I did Worlds with Team Canada.
Okay.
And that was just out of convenience, is that since we were already over there, we already had everything lined up. I was staying at a place called the Chainstay in Oudenaarde.
Oh, you were okay with Greg?
Yeah. With Greg, Gary Milburn was over there too. Mark McConnell was over there. So we were all staying at the Chainstay, and we sort of had our setup going already. Whereas the Cycling Canada project was really good for juniors, U23s, even elites who were coming over for just this short, intensive period and just couldn't, they wouldn't know how to figure out the logistics stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my question, is how you were able to jump into the figuring out the logistics. It's funny. I think this is now, Greg's on the Chainstays on a, three podcast streak now with Marion and Arlie and now you.
Yeah, I was actually laughing, and I was looking at who you'd had on, listening to some of them, that, you know, you just got to add Gary and McConnell and you pretty much have the whole, which both would be great people for your show.
Yeah, I talked to McConnell was actually on the very first one, but just a short little interview with him, but I gotta get him back at some point.
Yeah, and we did the same trip, but he'll have a different perspective on racing in Europe, as I'm sure everyone who goes over there would.
Yeah, I was gonna make the comment when you were talking about how you just sort of get lost at the end of these bigger races, and it's not fun because you're not racing for anything. It's like you don't have a beard, so you don't have people like cheering for you every lap either.
that's kind of a funny point. I'm limited by my physical capabilities as well when it comes to growing a beard. But that's just, I realized pretty quickly, and that's like, that is Mark's personality. That's who he is. And that's great. And I realized quickly, that's just not me. I'm not a showman like that, and I'm never going to be, you know, so there's no point in trying to grow a big mustache or a mullet or whatever the heck would make me stick out like this.
So, you know, getting back to, you know, and you sort of answered what my question was going to be a little bit, but it's really, you know, I'm always interested in somebody like yourself going over to Europe and how do you, you know, for some of the U.S., there's like Jeff Proctor over there, and there's a Belgian house, and there's a little bit of an infrastructure, like this is how you do things. How do you just, who was there to sort of help you show the way? This is how you survive. This is how you, you know, get to a race. This is where you need to be and what to do. Or were you just like figuring it out blind?
A little bit of both. So I think I had been sort of unconsciously preparing for Europe for a number of years. I mean, Sean Adamson, who, like I said, until this year had been my coach for 5 years, went over and spent two full seasons there. Craig Ritchie, who I built the team with, spent a couple seasons in Europe, and both of them stayed at the Chainstay, and Mark McConnell had stayed at the Chainstay once before. So the established infrastructure is, one, I had a lot of people who had been there before, over the span of a number of years, sort of telling me what to expect. And that made a huge, huge difference just in terms of what I would need in equipment. And, you know, like you see some riders, especially from non-cyclocross countries or growing cyclocross countries like Australia, it's like they just don't know that you need two sets of mud tires and stuff like that, that we, a lot of us realize, but also it's sort of been ingrained into me over the past 4 or 5 seasons. So I went over, and then the Chainstay provided a lot of infrastructure that would have been really difficult to organize by myself.
Yeah, and so for people who don't know Chainstay, what Greg runs is basically this house in Belgium where you can rent a room, and then even if you're not a professional cyclist, just do like cycling tours, that kind of stuff. But that's what he's built to do.
Yeah, and it's really great. I mean, I think it's getting booked up quicker and quicker every year as people are going over and realizing that they really need help with this, all this, establishing all this infrastructure. It's not like you can go over and, I mean, you can, but it's super hard to go over and stay in a hotel and rent a car because you're coming home from every weekend with these two super muddy bikes. And like, what do you do with them? Or how do you find mechanics? How do you get to and from the races? All this stuff. And we were fortunate that a lot of that was sort of in place at the Chainstay. And then on top of that, I went in with Mark and Gary and another Australian junior, Noah Barrow, and we ended up renting an RV for almost the entire season, which was like a huge financial investment. But we sort of went, you know what, going over here as American and Australian riders, we're already at sort of a disadvantage just in terms of not being used to racing in Europe. We need to take advantage of everything else we possibly can. So having an RV, just having somewhere to shower after your pre-ride and somewhere to sit down, because you're at these races for 3 or 4 hours at a time, like having a table to sit at and have hot soup and stuff like that. I think it proved, over the course of an entire season, proved to be incredibly valuable.
Oh, that seems like it'd be huge just to have a home base and not be around. Yeah.
And you can get away with doing a couple weekends without an RV, no problem. But it just wears down on you after you're there for a long time. I think everyone talks about the Belgian fans and how they're always there and they always want you to give them rider cards or to sign. And like it's great. It's cool to feel like a professional athlete for the first time in my life. But on the other hand, you want your dressing room where you can get away from all that.
Right. Yeah. And you also, you know, there's got to be something, even with just an RV, I'm sure you're feeling it. But if you're just like in an easy up and you're walking by and then you see the Telenet Fidea Village with the 8 buses and 6 Sprinter vans and everything else.
And people, it's funny too, but, you know, I think it's probably a recurring theme among lots of people who go over to Belgium. It was in Jeff Proctor's book, but parking, getting into races and parking can be a bit of a pain, but you get a lot more respect when you're coming in an RV.
Right. Yeah. No, it seems like, and just from the people I've talked to, is like that guy in charge of the parking lot is one of the most powerful men in Belgium.
Yeah. It was really funny. So I know Amanda Naumann touched on this too. But going to France, it was like it was a completely different parking experience than any race that we had done in Belgium. So in France, it was like first come, first serve. So all the juniors are in there, and then all the women are in there, and then all the elite men. And you're like, this is the first time I've ever seen the Telenet vehicles parked more than 100 meters from the start line, right?
Right, right, yeah.
They're the last ones to show up. So like you would sort of expect, it was just a first come, first serve. There was no, they weren't saving spots for anyone else. We're in Belgium. It's always the same races. So it's like, this is Telenet spot, and this has been Telenet spot for the last 15 years. So you cannot take it.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Oh, and I'm sure in France too, they took special pride in making Telenet and all the other big Belgian teams go far away.
The FDJ bus was,
I was just going to ask if the FDJ bus was like up front.
Which, it's funny because there's not actually an FDJ team, but I think they just lend their bus out.
Well, Francis Moret shows up. Well, no, I guess not anymore. He's no longer on the team. So, yeah.
What his team was called, but they basically couldn't afford him this year, so he had to go somewhere else. But yeah, so the parking's funny. But even with, so Gary and his wife Fiona had been there the year before, and been there the year before with an RV, and even some of the parking tenants begin to remember them, and they would like, it's amazing. People, the fans, the parking attendants, everyone in Belgium has a better idea of my results and what races I'm doing than I do. They were like, oh yes, you were 40th place in whatever race. And I'm like, I was? Huh. Go figure. What do you know?
That's great.
So like they know that Gary's coming, and the parking attendants, like sometimes he had a spot saved for him. It was incredible.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wow. That's sort of cool. But you know, it is, we're in awe of it, but at the same time, it's just like what you said before. It's the people who are going to those minor league baseball games, who know stats from every player who's, you know, in Triple A and even beyond that. So, but it's got to be a cool experience.
One of the funnier, or one of the more that really really exemplified this attitude, is people come and ask you for rider cards all the time. But someone came with a card collector book and with photos that they found on the internet printed off of all my different rider cards from every single year I'd had them. And they came up to me and showed me a printed off photo of my 2013 one. And they went, oh, do you have this rider card?
Wow.
Went, no. Maybe in a box at home or something, but where did you get that from? I wasn't even in Europe that year.
That's amazing. That's so funny.
Yeah. And they would like cross your name off the list when they got it from you. It's just a whole nother level of fandom that we're not used to here. It's not a part of the cyclocross culture in Canada or America, and maybe it never will be. And I think that's just perfectly fine.
Yeah, no, it's such a cool thing, and I always enjoy, you know, people going over there for the first time and they're freaking out because they don't have their rider cards. And so you briefly touched on what your goals were for last season, and you know, what are your thoughts on how that year went, and what are we looking to do going forward?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, I think this last season was a turning point for me. Actually, I had some decent results up until then, but this was the first year where I finished some races and really felt like I wanted more. You know, wanted to do better and wanted to win and wanted to make it to the next level of the sport. And one of the biggest examples of this was our nationals this year. For so long in my cycling career, I'd been moving up and valuing out like, I really suffered today. I rode really hard and that's great. And I'm happy with that. And this year at nationals, for those of you who don't know, Raf ended up winning. We played a very sort of tactical team game. Talking to people after the races, I got a text from Sean that basically said, I watched the race, great work, happy Raf won, but you know you could have won, right? And I think until I crossed the line there, I actually didn't. I didn't. It's the same thing of like having lowered expectations I've been giving myself almost too easy of a ride for too long. Like, oh yeah, I rode really hard and Raf won, that's great, I'm happy. But after I crossed the line at Nationals and lost that sprint for third to Aaron, I think something clicked and I went, you know what, I really, really wanted that. And I'm not very happy with myself that maybe I didn't give myself a little bit more of a chance. And I don't think I would never change the outcome with Raf winning there, but something that Adam said to me just after that race sort of stuck in. He's like, Mike, you're too good now to just ride around hard. You can't do that anymore. And throughout that season, that I sort of kept on realizing that that had been that I'd become a pretty decent cross racer without ever really learning how to win.
That's really cool. And it's also, it's something that at least in cyclocross, unlike road where the team dynamics are so different, it's like you're allowed to win and you're allowed to win against your teammate. You know, once it comes down to, you can be tactical at some point, but eventually it's everybody for themselves.
And I should be clear, like those, the tactics we did at Nationals, those were the tactics that we felt we needed to do to beat Scott Three Rocks, which of course is Jeff Kabush, Derek Sancher. Like, they aren't cross racers, so to speak, but they're very good racers. So basically what happened is I let out a lot of the race. We always made sure that we had one of us in between the two Three Rocks guys. And when Raph attacked, there's no such thing as blocking and cross, but there is such a thing as going to the front and riding a little bit slower than... It gives people a false sense of security, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You're around in a group at tempo, and meanwhile your teammate's out there smashing at threshold. He's getting a gap, but yet you're still going a decent enough speed that people aren't like, oh, we should really chase.
Right, yeah, you're basically...
That's the thing at Cycle Smart. The second day of Cycle Smart is like, Raph was off the front, and I'm kind of riding around on the front, kind of hard, but not really, and Raph's gap is just growing and growing and growing.
So I guess the goal then is, and it really is interesting what you say, that I think is really important, and it's a theme that I've heard, because I like interviewing guys like yourself, you know, and people who are sort of right on that cusp and coming up. And I really think it is that next step is learning how to win. And it's cool being in that position where that's a lesson you now have to learn.
Mm-hmm. And I won a race since then, at CSI, which is really great. But on the flip side, I still am learning how to win. That race was Raph worked. We flipped the cards, right? You know, in that race, Raph worked for me in sort of, I don't want to say repayment, but you know, I had helped him out in Nationals. He helped me on CSI, and we had a really good team relationship there. But it was even later on, moving past Nationals, moving into Europe. Up until that point, I'd always sort of, you know, looked at people that banged their bars or were inconsolable at the end of the races. Been like, what are you doing? I don't get it. And then as I started racing and wanted these results more and more and more, I think most people tell you that I'm a pretty easygoing, pretty happy person almost all the time. But I started realizing how much I wanted it after the Nome World Cup. And at that point, we're racing for 40th place. We're not racing for first place. 40th place is where the prize money ends, which is sort of funny. I mean, I was racing for 40th place and was sitting in like 38th or something like that. And just got caught up in a stupid little crash on the last lap. And in the way that Nome World Cup played out is there was big groups. The gaps were really tight. It was a really dumb course. But so I got passed by like five people, ended up in 43rd or 44th or whatever, wherever I was. And yeah, was actually upset at the end of the race. And I was actually upset at the end of Nationals. And that wasn't something that had happened for me before this season. It's like, I know I wanted more. And in Nome, I really wanted that 40th. And Nationals, I really wanted that podium. And then moving past that and into the Zolder Worlds, being able to be really disappointed with yourself and being able to move past that and use that as fuel for the future, I think is something that I'm still learning. And that's a big part of wanting to win or learning how to win is being disappointed. You know, before this, I'd been happy if I'd just gone around and ridden as hard as I could and felt like I did everything I could. Whereas now I'm growing into doing that, but also being happy with the race or being satisfied with the race. Like if I can win my group or win the race. And I think that's a step that probably all athletes who started winning races had to make at some point in time. You know, you can't just be, you're not satisfied with just like, oh yeah, I was kind of there. I was in the race for a while. In order to win, you have to really want to win.
I think it's neat listening to you talk about that now. And it makes me really want to see how things go for you in the coming year. So you're racing on the road now. Do you do any mountain biking at all or racing, or is it all road?
I haven't done mountain biking for 4 years now. So that was my entryway into the sport, but, and I regret it a little bit, but I stopped mountain biking 4 years ago to do road. I thought at that point there was more opportunity for me on the road. And I think in a lot of respects, I was right. And now that now there's more opportunity for me across. So I've actually toned down my road season a lot as opposed to years past. We're seeing a lot. We're seeing that in North American cyclocross and definitely in Belgian cyclocross, you just can't do both properly. Right. The season is so long from, especially this year, from Rochester in September through to the World Championships. You can't add a road season in front of that, at least not a full road season. So even guys who are racing road for pro teams like Steven Hyde is doing a condensed road season. Sure. You know, he's only racing road for he's using it as a tool to build his form and to help his teammates out. But it's all fitting in with the big plan to race cross starting in September.
Right. So where does your season start for cyclocross?
I sort of have the luxury of being a Canadian and not having to worry about UCI points that much. I know a lot of your conversation with Amanda is talking about, like, how do you get inside that top 50?
You know what? I never even thought about this. It's really funny listening to you say that. Yeah, absolutely right.
Like, I don't have to worry about that. I mean, obviously having more UCI points is good. It moves me up on the start grid, but I'm going to get a World Cup selection at everything. And I mean, I'll get it next year, but at any year, pretty much everything except for the North American ones, it's almost automatic because we just don't have five people out there, right?
Yeah, no, that's great. So, yep.
When I want to race the World Cup, I can race the World Cup, which gives me a lot of freedom. And I think you talked about strategically picking races a lot with Amanda too, and that there's different ways to do that. So whereas Amanda's way, which is completely valid, that's a strategy that she has chosen. I agree. She's not cherry picking races. Like that's a choice that you make, and you have to be aware of the sort of the benefits and the disadvantages of choosing to race C2s instead of C1s. But I can take the opposite approach. And this upcoming season, I'm basically only going to race C1s or C1 weekends because I'm not so worried about the UCI points. And I think it's more valuable for me to have the exposure and the opportunity to race against Hyde and Powers and Driscoll every single weekend.
Yeah, you know, I think that's great. That's exciting. That's a cool way to do it. And it's even, you know, it's another one of those progressions in where, you know, we were talking about the first time in New England and then the Belgian races and now sort of, you know, getting yourself to where you can feel comfortable and feel like you belong in the front of those races as well or up near those front groups.
And that's something I really believe is no one gets better by being comfortable, right? It's like I think I'm at the level now whereas most of the standalone C2 races, I would be in the group that has the chance to win. I'm not saying I'm going to win them, but I'm strong enough to have that opportunity every single weekend. And that's great. And I'm sure I would maybe be able to come away with a few more wins if I did that. And I would, again, have the opportunity to learn to do that. But on the flip side, by throwing myself in against Powers and Hyde and those guys, like those are the guys my goal is to race with those guys next year, whether or not I beat them. But like, that's where I want to be. So why would I go anywhere else except that be able to constantly compare myself at a level where I am and where I want to be and be able to mark improvements from that and at the same time be able to show myself to sort of the you know the real pro team, Charlie Clement, Cannondale, be able to show myself to them every single weekend to be like, look at me, I want on your team.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's great. And yeah, I look forward to following your progress as we make it through the year. And I'm sure I'll catch up with you in person at Vegas and Jingle Cross.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. I look forward to actually, I probably won't listen to it. I hate hearing myself speak. I look forward to other people telling me that they listen to it.
Awesome. All right, Mike. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
And there you have it. That was Michael Vandenham. Great conversation. You can follow along with his career next year at mvdhcyclocross.com. Also, give him a follow on Twitter at mvdhcyclocross. Thanks for joining us today for this episode. If you got anything to say, questions, comments, concerns, otherwise, send them all to feedback@cxhairs.com. Also, remember to go check out the Wide Angle Podium at wideanglepodium.com. Sign up to support some of the podcasts that you listen to. Crosshairs Radio, Kids Don't Follow, Slow Ride Podcast, Honest Bicycle Program, and the Meyerson Line. We will catch you next time. See you then.